Vespers doesn't start for another hour. If you're this is about Grunewald, and I don't know how many of you are expecting Vespers, but that's not for a while. How many of you have ever heard of Grunewald? The rest of you are expecting Vespers. or maybe you're just expecting one of Rich's crazy friends, and that's what you'll get. This is kind of amazing. We have done, this is the 10th and the last of the series for the summer. We'll head out on Saturday, and we've got one to go, and for some wondrous and marvelous reason, Grunewald winds up to be the last one. And it sort of goes to prove some kind of contention of mine that if certainly not in the world, all things fitly joined together for those who are of the household of God, certainly it happens that way at Holden. I have a problem back in Valparaiso making things fit, making one thing fit into another thing. I have a problem hooking up my family life to my academic life. I have a problem hooking up both my family and academic life to my creating of art life. And I have a problem hooking up those three lives to the business life, which runs a corporation of 14 artisans, and we make stained glass all over the world. Those are so many different things, and none of them seem to fit together. In fact, even parts of those various things don't seem to fit together. The academic life for me is a time, in the classroom at least, where, as I've said to some of you, I spend probably the first 15 minutes of every lecture trying to convince the students to forget the last 15 minutes of the last lecture that they came from. That's right. And that they are required, both for their well-being, I got the grade, and for my well-being, because I need to have them there, they are required to shift tremendous gears. So they come from biology and theology and chemistry and whatever the discipline. Business, that's the biggest gear to shift. Business major coming into one of my art lectures. I don't know, you know, woofta, I don't know how those poor people do it, and I got a hunch at the end of the semester after reviewing the work that most of them don't. But, you know, but at any rate, it's a hard thing, and you really kind of feel like a piece, huh? Like just a little piece, and you can't make connections, or one little moment, one little day feels like a piece. We'll talk about that more tomorrow night at Vespers. But for now, it just seems like things do not fitly join together, that there's too much fragmentation. And golly, the first day you get up to Holden Village, the most wondrous thing to me that happens has nothing to do with the scenery. It has nothing even to do with the people or anything to do with the lectures or all of that. It's the fact that it is all made up of one piece. That no matter where you are, if you're in your room, or you're in the woods, or you're here, or from here to Vespers, it's all one thing. I guess in some ways I don't quite agree with what John said last night at Vespers about how we have to shift gears, and that maybe the young folks are better at it than the old folks. I really don't think that there is all that much gear shifting going on, because there is so much connecting being done from one thing, whether it's foolishness or another thing, whether it's celebration or another thing where it's serious counseling, all those kinds of things seem to fit into one thing, which to me, you want to call it Holden? I don't know. But I think it ought to be happening somewhere else. You know, it's too big a burden to dump all on one place. But I think, you know, the extended family of the body of Christ, that, if you want to call it that. And I think Grunewald, at this particular point, and it's not your history or the village's history that you were talking about right now, it's my history. Because I decided with my family that maybe we should do some simplifying of our life and our life together, that maybe we should try a different way of teaching and working and living together, and we should simplify it. We should have a company of folks who like the land and who like to make good and excellent things like art objects and all of that, and we should live together. Community, if you will, extended family sounds a little bit better to me. And it started out so simple, and it's gotten extremely complicated, and now I've got to get it simpler again. But even before the scheduling got worked out, look what we were going to call it. Here's the file. Oh, I don't like most of this has to do with that bunch of guys that sat in the back of my class, the business administration students. Oh, and what did we call it? What did we decide to name it? The Grunewald Guild. Names are very important, you know. I love Grunewald because his name is almost as weird as mine, and he was a good artist. So, you know, maybe if that's possible, an artist with a weird name like Kemmerer can also be a good artist. The problem is that Grunewald was a total unknown. From the time that he worked, he was born, he was so unknown, nobody even knows, you know, when he was born. I think that's embarrassing, isn't it? 1480. I'll give you a date. If anybody asks you when Grunewald was born, say 1480. That's within 5 years, all right? And nobody will ask you, but, you know, it's nice to say in the middle of a conversation, hey, did you know Grunewald was born in 1480? And people will, you know, wow, you know. And I thought you were a dummy. You really, you know, you really know lots of good things. And 1480 was a kind of a rough time. It was a kind of a rough time in Europe, in Germany. There was war, problems with Spanish folks. Spanish folks, when they got up into Europe, did some really messy things. They kind of neat in Spain, but they should not have messed around with Holland and places like that. But at any rate, there was a lot of general upheaval. Some contemporaries of Grunewald, I think of one guy you may be more familiar with than Grunewald, a fellow by the name of Dürer, Albrecht Dürer, the first Missouri Synod Lutheran artist. We're talking German now, folks. Most of you don't qualify, so don't laugh. It's about time we get a little German in here. Yeah, Jan, you and your... Well, I didn't say which Missouri Synod he belonged to. I just said that he was the first. At any rate, he was, Dürer says, the greatest thing that an artist can do is to paint the suffering, agony, and death of Jesus Christ. That's the kind of time that it was. And Dürer spent most of his life doing exactly that. Grunewald, we have a very little output from. I mean, this guy is not going to be spectacular. This guy, in his output at least, he's not going to be spectacular in his little detail like Van Eyck. Van Eyck, you know, you can go ooh and ah and scratch your head and wonder how he did it. Grunewald, you got to look and scratch your head and wonder why he did it. Really? Why did he do it this way? He's one of my crazy friends, but we cannot sit at this particular time and spend too much time cracking wise about the nature of art, because what Grunewald talks to us about is the nature of faith. Punkt. Period. That's it. And it's the nature of faith as it is seen through the eyes of people that assume that the best thing to do is the suffering, the pain, and the anguish of Jesus and of all the people that had anything to do with him. It was great Sturm und Drang. That's also German, so we know what we're talking about. All right? Very, very heavy stuff. Now, for centuries from the time that he painted until he, until the middle of this past century, he was an unknown. They didn't know who painted his work. In fact, what work they could find, they put the name of another artist on. Now, that's despicable. I mean, if you can't even have your own name, you know, what do you got? But they took his own name away and put a stranger's name onto his work. They made something up like Hans Baldunk Green. If you're going to make up a name, is that a name to make up? You know, Hans Baldunk Green? And not G-R-E-E-N, G-R-I-E-N, you know. Green. It's not pleasant. It's not pleasant. We got unpleasant names earlier. Hans was talking to us earlier about King Lear's ugly daughter. I can't even remember her name. It's so ugly. What's her name? Goner. Yeah, sounds like a venereal disease. Yeah. Yeah. You know. Really. You gotta watch out for names. You gotta watch out what you call your kids. You know? What are people gonna have to spend the rest of their life being called Hans Baldung Green? You know? And it didn't matter because it was a made-up name. But so is Grunewald. There's nobody named Grunewald. Isn't that nice to have a crazy friend? With no name. This is a name. They lost. They lost his history completely. They got all of his paintings together because there were only about 18 paintings. 18 paintings, all done in exactly the same style. But the guy who they thought was Hans Baldung Green and who they ascribed 60-some paintings to winds up to be a completely another guy, and that leaves 18 paintings unaccounted for in the history of art. And they said, let's call him Grunewald. That's a nice... Grunewald? The Green Woods. The Green Woods. I don't know why they named him that. I really don't. But Grunewald's output, as small as it is, includes... You know, of those 18 paintings, 9 of them are in one painting, which is kind of cheating. 9 of them are all framed together in one thing called the Eisenheim altarpiece, and has been called in recent times, although it wasn't attributed like this in earlier times, but now it's been called the greatest masterpiece of the European Middle Ages. Which is kind of high-blown. I think they're just sort of making up for lost time because they gave this poor man such shabby treatment. But now, it's on the top 5 of everybody's all-time hit parade of great paintings. It really is. It is an incredible thing, and it represents the Middle Ages like no other painting that I can think of, because it tells us something about the nature of man and the relationship that we have here on earth to the system ordained by the Heavenly Father for our salvation. And it says it in some of the most graphic, you kids close your eyes, in some of the most angry, and at the same time, some of the most gospel-oriented kinds of visages that you can possibly imagine. It is because of Grunewald that some people have made the statement that there was no Renaissance in Germany. That in Germany they went right from the Gothic Age to the Baroque. The Baroque is certainly very German. Down in Munich, all those little chubby-butted angels floating around in the ceiling with little rear ends like bread dough, you know. little mating going on between the Michelin Man and the Pillsbury Doughboy, you know. Little offspring hanging around blowing little trumpets, you know, that kind of thing. That's Baroque, huh? And yet the Gothic age was tremendous. Tremendous in the north. Stained glass windows. The carvings on the fronts of the cathedrals, the great cathedrals of Köln and Ulm. All good German stuff going on up there in the Gothic age. But between the Gothic and the Baroque, there was a whole thing going on somewhere else called the Renaissance. And it seems to have made little or no impact in the visual art of the North. And I think one of the reasons, at least as evidenced by Grunewald, and particularly as we see it in the Eisenheim altarpiece, is that the faith of these people that they professed visually was too strong at this time to allow Christ to be only a Superman. A Superman Jesus would just not do it at this time in Germany. Later, maybe. But not now. Not now. Let's look at him. Look at some early ones, just a few little small things, and as I say, they're really very, very rare. Maybe we got a dozen paintings we can look at that would show you the style of Grunewald. And you can see we're talking about the suffering God, the suffering, agonizing, and ultimately dead God. And when they did it in Germany at this time, they did not attempt to make it pretty. In fact, my whole idea of the crucifixion as being the ultimate pornography probably comes more from Grunewald than from anyone else. Passion, sorrow, distortion. Excruciating agony. That's the head of that Karlsruhe crucifixion. It's almost as though in the process of painting, Grunewald wants to do a little bit of the beating on the thorns. You know, the artist does not have to make it this ugly. One or two thorns would have done really good. It would have done the job, but Grunewald's got a whole bush right there on the head. And it's not just sitting there, it is beaten in. The lips are pulled back. The tongue is swollen. The face is in torment. He did other things on commission. This is kind of a funny painting. This is a painting of two saints. One of them is a archbishop, and the other one is a black knight, Saint Mauritius. It's kind of interesting to see that in the history of German painting. The whipping of Christ, the torment of Christ, is not something which is just simply an ecce homo or behold the man kind of thing. It is the local natives going after him hammer and tong. That's exactly what it is. It's bestiality. And not bestiality in the abstract, but it's local German folk undertaking all of this stuff. He did quite a series of paintings of the crucifix, of the crucifixion. All of them showing Christ particularly in extremes of agony and pain. But probably the most important one is this painting. Now what we have in the Eisenheim altar, and I'll show you this over on the left, is actually a series. This is called a polytip, which is a whole sequence of paintings occurring at the same time. You open this thing up on various occasions so that on the outside you have these four paintings. Two side panels that fold over, and a retable at the bottom, and then the great center painting. Now that center painting opens up and spreads out. There's a great crack right down the middle. It's hinged. When it opens up, that's what's on the inside. On the left, you have the Annunciation. Then you have a strange, peculiar, weird, and not altogether pleasant nativity, which we'll look at. And on the right, one of the most dramatic resurrections in all of the history of art. But the retable, which is the death of God in the entombment, stays, in spite of all that rather joyous subject matter. Now this opens up also. So we had four paintings on the first one. The retable stays the same, and we have three more paintings across the top. And on the final painting, when you open it up, you have two more paintings plus a carved judgment in the center. So you have nine paintings all together. And that's the first one that we want to look at. And this is the center panel, which is probably the most famous, the most well-known, and certainly deserving of praise. We look at it for a lot of reasons. One is the composition. We know, even though we're talking 1480s, we're talking 1500s, and the Renaissance has been going full blast, all right? The Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci, easy date to remember, 1492. Huh? Okay, that's when Leonardo was going full swing down in the south. And what was Leonardo trying to do? Create that infinite space and try and make Jesus without his halo so that he becomes really just simply another one of the boys. Up north, very much contemporary with all of that, comes Grunewald, who is doing all of this distortion. Distortion so much that many people contribute the German Expressionist movement to origins that date from Grunewald. And in fact, it was during the period of German Expressionism that Grunewald finally becomes popular again. And now huge books are written about his work. But if you can imagine, from German Expressionism, that's 1930, from 1480 to 1930, nobody knew who this guy was or called him by the wrong name. Here we have typical Gothic arrangement. The thing is cracked right down the middle so that we can open it up. It folds out. We have tremendous distortion here. John and Mary and a little tiny Mary Magdalene down here. She's a sinner. She's not one of the great ones. So as in a typical Gothic tradition, they make her smaller. They're setting the priority in the style of the painting. And over here, John the Baptist, who wasn't even there. This is not a historical scene at all. This is allegory. And there is John the Baptist with a little lamb. A little lamb who has his foot, his paw, around a cross and is bleeding from his chest into a chalice. All at the same time that Leonardo da Vinci is doing problems with anatomy and space and sfumato and all of those unique and interesting problems of visual reality, in the north, Grunewald is saying, visual reality. This is nicht genug. It is not enough. What you see is not what you get. It is what you know that is what you get. And John the Baptist points with his finger. Who was it? Niebuhr, I think, said something about John the Baptist. He said that finger pointing to Jesus has a carbuncle on it. Now on either side, as you can see up on either side, we got saints. On one side, Saint Anthony. And on the other side, Saint Sebastian, pierced by spears. You gotta understand the context of this. In art, like probably most stuff, but it was never truer than art, there is no text without context. What are those two people doing up there? I'll tell you. Mary, in the habit of a nun, has fainted. John is supporting her, having gotten the commission to take care of her. Mary Magdalene's hands have practically gone right through the ringer. They have turned into macrame. They are so knotted up. Her hair is covering herself in a net of tangled mess like seaweed. Everything is twisted and distorted. Whoa. And there's the carbuncle. And right between the hand and the face is written, so nobody will mistake, a complete antithesis to visual reality, written in Latin, "He must increase, and I must decrease." And the corpse on the cross. You gotta know the history to this. It was commissioned by a hospital, a group of pious business people put together a hospital, and the hospital was run by monks, and the entire treatment carried on in that hospital was for the care of Saint Anthony's fire. Remember Saint Anthony. Saint Anthony's fire is a hard thing to describe. Even history isn't sure exactly what it is. Some people have said that it was a venereal disease, like syphilis. We have to hopefully discount that, since three cardinals missed the last vote assembly for the new pope because they were suffering from St. Anthony's fire. And I don't think they would have advertised it. But at any rate, it was an excruciatingly painful disease. Your body turned black. You broke out in huge, egregious sores. The infected fluids in those sores would just spurt like geysers. your body just decayed in front of your very eyes, and it was extremely, extremely painful. It sounds also like there was a kind of it was an admixture of things which might have included shingles. For anybody who's ever gone through that, you would know that not even lying down is of any comfort to you. At any rate, take a room like this room. This will be a hospital ward, about the size of a hospital ward. On that wall, beds. On this wall, beds. All lined up with little curtains between each bed. Every day the monks would make the rounds, change the bandages, and try and make the people as comfortable as possible. But the moaning and the groaning must have been atrocious. When a patient was brought to this place for the treatment of St. Anthony's fire, the first thing that he was told to do, and in fact was assisted in doing, was visit at that end of the room where the stage is, the Eisenheim altarpiece, on which hung Christ Jesus himself having died of St. Anthony's fire. His body is infested with all the pus and pustules, with all the egregious, disgusting coloration of that particular sin. Once again, Grunewald has decided this is not history we are talking about, this is now. And God is not dying for whoever came before us, but is dying there for all of us with whatever we got hanging on him, and he is taking it to the death. He is killing it on his own body. And as these poor wretches lay on their beds of pain, they could see 24 hours a day their Lord Jesus Christ hanging up there, dying from exactly the same thing. In the next panel, I don't know if anybody would like to go up there and shut that door, but it would help. On the next panel, you've got a series of things which are a little crazy. One book, a very fat, learned dissertation on Grunewald, says that the Annunciation and the Virgin Mary of the Nativity are so unlike Grunewald at his best that I shall not include it in this book. Boy, that's a cheap shot. I mean, I think Grunewald must have worked pretty hard, but the writer of the book doesn't like him. I'll just show him, because I don't like him very much either. But I'll show him to you to give you an idea. It's typical. In fact, we saw with Van Eyck, remember the Annunciation in the cathedral? Here's another one. Whoa, I don't want to do that. There's the angel of the Annunciation. The Virgin Mary is reading the story, the prophecies from the Old Testament. In the center are some very strange things. You have a choir of angels down in one corner, and the Virgin Mary holding on to a little chubby baby with a volcano in the background about ready to erupt. And in the volcano are a couple of other strange things. Here's part of the choir, the little angel choir. Oh, they're darling. They're really cute. I don't know what they're doing there, but they're really nice. Look at that. Look at the kid. That is a very strange baby. Mary, I think, should be holding it better, for one thing. But it's a little bit misshapen. Looks like a side of beef, actually. But there is a neat connection here. Do you see the swaddling clothes? Boy, talk about rags. They are, look at the rags they're going to wrap that baby in. I think she just changed her mind and decided not to wrap him around in that stuff. Took it all off. It looked bad. But the rags on that baby are the same style, the same raggedy stuff that we saw wrapped around, do you see him up there? Around Jesus at his crucifixion. Grunewald's way, I think, of making a visual connection between the nativity and the crucifixion. Up in the sky. This is a really strange thing. In the temple there. Can you make her out? That's a heavenly version of the Virgin. This could be the Revised Standard Virgin. Well, she's in there. Can you see her, where she is in here? She's sticking out between the little pillars of the Gothic church there. She's looking down. So we got two virgins. We've got a plain old housefrau with shabby dressing for the baby. And we got this lady peeking between the columns here, who is a heavenly Madonna with a crown on her head. That's strange. That's weird and not altogether like Grunewald. I got a hunch that some of the donors of the painting had some suggestions about what to include in here. But on the right is the great resurrection. And it is one of the great resurrections of all time, but remember the context. What was the context? Filth, uncleanliness, the most horrible scabs and scarring, the body turning into a pool of pus. I'm sorry to be so graphic, but that's what it was. And the resurrection is white. I mean, look at them. It is just snowy white. Everything is cleaned up. Oh, you gotta love that for the gospel. For the whole message of the gospel to people on beds of pain. I can't think of anything, if I'm going to die like that I'd rather know about in my heart of hearts, that it's all working out. Not if, not maybe, but it's all been worked out already. The plan is done. The battle is over. It's hope, a great, great sign of hope. And at the foot of the cross, at the foot of the tomb, the soldiers. Now look at what was done at exactly the same time in Italy. Huh? Do you see the difference? Piero della Francesca, down in Italy, doing the same story. The soldiers even look kind of the same. But what is Jesus? A general. Huh? Isn't he? He just won a great victory or something, and he's standing in his little box. There is no hint of some kind of divinity other than that little gold plate that he's balancing on his head. Now, on the last panel, St. Anthony and St. Paul the Hermit are having a conversation in the wilderness. they are discussing some of the theology that was at the origins of this group that founded the hospital. These are the founders of the hospital. And they're kind of neat portraits. These are the lives of the saints that are ever and ever in front of the people who are lying there sick. Remember the lives of the saints. On the other side, can you see it? Are the torments. The torments of St. Anthony by demons in the wilderness. And Grunewald had an incredible imagination, because these demons are probably the most gruesome company of folk you'd ever want to have over for an evening. They are not even polite. They are chewing on everything they can get their hands on. Wood, rocks, St. Anthony, anything. Look at that poor man. Everything is attacking. Something's going on his hand, pulling at his fingers. They're stomping all over that poor man. Temptations. Constant temptations. And the one that is closest to us. Well, there's some crawling all over your roof. Every time I see this one, I think of from ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties and things that go bump in the night, good Lord, deliver us. I think of those things going bump in the night all over the roof of St. Anthony's house. They're coming to get you from all directions, and the closest one to you is this gruesome little booger down in the corner, the demon of St. Anthony's fire. That's what it looks like, folks. Grunewald can't give us the smell, but he can give us everything else. And so these people are saying, what you are suffering from is a temptation. Remember the saint that withstood all of the demons, including those that touched his body, that destroyed his skin, that ruined his complexion. All those things that caused him pain, he withstood. And he can do it, and you can do it. Why? Because it's already been done. A thing maybe most of us forget, that Jesus Christ is not just Lord of the good times, but the God of our messes. Thank you very much.